Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers,
and from the law firm of Primer, Piper, Eggleston, and Kramer, providing comprehensive legal counsel to New Hampshire businesses and their owners for more than 30 years. For more information or to speak to an attorney, visit primer.com. And from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate pick-your-own-farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Peter Biello, and this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. Along party lines, the Executive Council rejects Attorney General Gordon McDonald's nomination to the state Supreme Court. Nearly two-thirds of Medicaid recipients fail to comply with the state's work requirement, so the state takes action. And the Concord School Board examines how it handles allegations of sexual abuse. These and other stories made headlines this week, and we're going to talk about them in this hour. We also have a video of this conversation streaming right now at our Facebook page, and you can find it by going to Facebook and searching for NHPR Exchange. It's all one word. And here in the studio with me are Ethan DeWitt, reporter for the Concord Monitor, NHPR's Jason Moon, and Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU. Thank you very much, everybody, for being here. Really appreciate it.
Good morning.
Hey, Peter.
So we're going to start with the big story of the week, the rejection of Gordon McDonald as a candidate for the state Supreme Court. The Executive Council, as we mentioned, voted 3-2 along party lines to reject his nomination. Governor Sununu nominated him. Ethan, you were following this pretty closely before the vote. Did you see this result coming?
Well, so there were some early indications from Councilor Mike Cryens, he's the North Country councilor who took over. He's a Democratic councilor, but he took over from a Republican seat, and he's always kind of had a moderate voice. But he had, before this vote, expressed opposition. And basically the dynamic was if one Democrat peeled away from the three-person majority, then there would be three votes with two Republicans and one Democrat. So it was just kind of a guessing game as to who might split. And Cryens was kind of, if there were anyone to kind of feasibly split, he would have been the one. So his declaration of opposition was kind of a key thing. The governor said yesterday in a radio interview that he was still holding out hope for Cryens near the end.
Okay.
But I think that, and I should say I wasn't present for the hearing about 2 weeks ago, but during the hearing, I think all the Democratic councilors made pretty clear that they had at least heavy skepticism. So
and
at
what
that
was
point,
what was the skepticism based on?
Well, it seemed a lot in part due to his kind of past affiliations with the Republican Party. There was his representation of the Catholic diocese. And there was just sort of, you know, as we've kind of, it's sort of, there was a lot of talk this week about whether the New Hampshire process is starting to mirror Washington. And to what extent it does or doesn't, there are certainly more litmus test questions being raised in terms of how a future Supreme Court justice in New Hampshire might rule on things that might not have been asked 10 or 20 years ago. And so some of those, based on his history, for instance, especially with reproductive rights, were raised. There was concern that he wouldn't stand up for organizations like Planned Parenthood in certain rulings. And he declined to go into detail in his hearing, which kind of perpetuated that narrative. So there's a lot, but it was sort of kind of looking at his political affiliations of the past.
And after the vote, Sununu said Democrats had politicized the nomination process, and he called their treatment of McDonald reprehensible.
We have changed the paradigm. We have changed our system going forward, where politics is clearly, to the own words of the councilors here, going to be a litmus test. It is going to be on the table for consideration going forward now, apparently.
Governor Sununu speaking after the vote. Dean Spiliotis, your thoughts? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Ethan is correct. You could see this one coming, I think, from a bit of a distance away. And we can talk about the politicization of the process. There were these two arguments, one about conservative ideology and his work in conservative politics prior to becoming attorney general, actually looking pretty far back to his work as a legislative aide for Gordon Humphrey many years ago. So there's the ideology aspect of this. And there was also an argument about him not having any prior judicial experience, although other people have been elevated to the Supreme Court without prior judicial experience. It is true, however, that someone hadn't been elevated without experience directly to the Chief Justice, I think, in at least a century. So that aspect of it, elevating him directly to Chief Justice, was a little unusual. You know, this is just a kind of part of a larger process of politicization of the process that really started with Justice Bork, you know, 30 plus years ago. It used to be that certainly at the national level, if members of the Senate didn't like the politics of the nominee, as long as they were qualified in terms of their legal credentials, that was not considered in the decision-making process. And so you would have a conservative justice get a large majority in the Senate, including Democrats, and vice versa with liberal justices. That has now, I think, as a result of all the changes in the U.S. Senate and the Obama's nominee Merrick Garland not even getting a hearing, I think people increasingly view this as fair game politically. And you could see not only where the Democratic executive counselors were headed, but kind of the mobilization among Democratic activists on the ideology component. So yeah, the as they say, proverbial horse is out of the barn in terms of politicization locally, and we'll see what happens next. I think Governor Sununu has temporarily paused judicial nominees. In fact, I think he withdrew a second nominee as well, sort of in protest.
Yeah, Ethan, go ahead.
So in response, there has been there was kind of Gordon McDonald had sort of a widespread, at least within certain corners of the legal community, support that had been kind of shored up and was hoped to make him a bit of more of a consensus pick. And in the fallout from this, you kind of saw a lot of criticism from Democrats, most notably John Broderick, former Supreme Court Justice, who is a Democrat. One thing that people have also been doing is pointing to past examples as either examples of this being not in the out of the ordinary or completely out of the ordinary. And so two examples.
And when you say this, you mean the rejection of this, a particular Supreme Court nominee?
Yes, this rejection. So one thing I heard from Republicans in the last few days is looking at John Broderick. John Broderick was confirmed by a Republican-led executive council. He was, very kind of overtly, had aligned with Democratic views, including was a pro-choice, had pro-choice views, and at that point the council was pro-life. And so what people have said to me is there wasn't a litmus test at that point. In fact, that wasn't actually even asked by executive counselors, even the Republican ones, what his views were on reproductive rights, on abortion, et cetera. It was left off the table. It was kind of the nomination was entirely centered, and the decision was entirely centered around his kind of personal integrity and kind of what he would bring.
But Ethan,
to
that
the
was
role.
A long time ago. Long that was time Governor ago. Merrill. That was like 25 years
it
ago.
It was a
maybe.
Long time ago. So people,
that's part of the issue.
So people are kind of pointing to like past examples that are, you know, far removed. And as we've seen, kind of the standard in Washington now for any Supreme Court justice nominee is to be asked these questions and then to go before their hearing and say, I can't, you know, weigh in on legal questions that might come before me and kind of deflect every time. But sort of that wasn't a standard a while ago. The other example that people on the other side have been pointing to is Dorothy Graham, who was nominated a few years ago to be, I believe, around 2015, on the Superior Court, and at that point, Republican-led executive counsel rejected her because of her past experiences as being a public defender and who had kind of defended against individuals. So that was another, I thought, interesting.
Yeah, we got a comment from a listener, an anonymous listener, about that, to say the governor made statements about how this has never happened since he's been involved in the process. Wrong. He voted against a very highly qualified nominee, Dorothy Graham, nominated for the Superior Court. She had massive support, too, says this listener, including from all sides, prosecutors, police, even though her background was as a defense attorney. So, yeah, Dorothy Graham seems like an example.
Yeah, and the controversy there, especially, there was similar backlash from the legal community over that decision because they said it sort of denigrated the role of a public defender, which is meant to be this sort of, above the fray kind of thing. I mean, it's a kind of constitutional duty to give somebody a right to defense, even if the people might be privately seen to be less than reputable or whatnot. And so that was sort of, so people have drawn that comparison as this has been politicized before. But moving forward, I think the question is kind of, where does this go? These nominations are paused for now. It's unclear what would pass the litmus test for Democratic councilors at this point. There have been a few names put forward by Councillor Velinsky, who's notably exploring a run for governor. And so there's that dynamic as well.
So, well, can, a few things to unpack there. I mean, it's worth sort of explicitly drawing out the governor's response here because Democrats were not happy with it. And so, Deborah Pignatelli, another executive councillor, called it childish. The immediate withdrawal of the nomination of Marty Honigberg to the, I think it was the Superior Court, yes?
Yes.
Yeah. So maybe I'll go to you, Dean.
Sure.
What do you make of that? Is that just blatant retaliation, or is it effective political pressure, or something else?
Well, you know, I think there's a lot going on here. Obviously, we have the partisan dynamics between the two parties. We're going into an election year. Governor Sununu is going to run for re-election as governor. Party, you know, partisan politics and politicization of institutional processes is always quite nasty. You know, if we flip the parties and it was a Democratic governor and a Republican majority executive council rejected a Democratic nominee on similar grounds, you know, you'd probably have a very strong reaction from Democrats. I mean, it is in some sense it's situational. You know, whether or not his response is childish, I'll let other people decide that. But it certainly signals to me to watch very closely whether there's any way to dial this back. Will there be some sort of compromise or some sort of, you know, everybody just takes a deep breath and they come up with some acceptable alternative? Or is this just going to kind of domino effect into a very, what everyone already believes is going to be a very bitter election season in 2020, both locally and nationally?
In terms of time frame, you know, there's been talk about how the summer is very slow for the Supreme Court, and so there may not be a lot lost by having a four justice Supreme Court through the summer, and that gives them a little bit of time. Similarly with the budget, you know, maybe the continuing resolution. There's talk about kind of this need to kind of cool off because this week has definitely come to a head on a multitude of fronts in the State House, in the Executive Council, et cetera. But I've actually heard from some Republicans, speak about bringing the Washington process to New Hampshire. Some have said, why do we need to confirm anybody until the election? If this is how this vote went, why not hold the nominations until November 2020, which would be a very Washington thing to do, something that we've seen recently. But some people are actually kind of quietly pushing for that. I don't know if that's what the governor would ever do, but it's just kind of notable that that's sort of when you move the Overton window in some ways, that it opens the potential for some of these things you wouldn't think might happen in the process in New Hampshire to be considered.
Comments from some listeners. Monica emailed to say, I noticed that Governor Sununu's executive order for Judicial Selection Commission does not contain any of the qualification criteria that all of the prior executive orders had contained. And I wonder if McDonald would have been nominated had these criteria been in Sununu's order. It's a comment from Monica. And Amelie wrote in to say, I support Councillor Pignatelli's statement regarding Gordon McDonald. Mr. McDonald lacked a judicial record for the council to review. New Hampshire citizens deserve better. Amelie continues, I hope Governor Sununu decides to work with the executive council and can put forth a candidate who is more representative of the state's citizens. Thank you very much, Amelie, for your comment. Thanks also to Monica for writing in. Again,
I mean, can I just jump in?
That
was a nice way of laying out the two issues. On the one hand, this issue of judicial experience. And, you know, at the U.S. Supreme Court, every time there's a vacancy, there's all this fun speculation about all these potential non-traditional appointments. But in the end, it always ends up being somebody elevated from the U.S. Court of Appeals. And so that's the more typical type of process. So, you know, one question is, do you really need to have prior judicial experience if you're a very experienced lawyer and an attorney general? The other issue raised by that comment is kind of the issue of a judge who more accurately reflects or represents Sununu. I'm not Sununu, the state of New Hampshire. And, you know, that's a political argument. You know, should justices reflect a particular viewpoint with regards to kind of the ideological mix of the state. And that's traditionally that has not been something that has been as considered as much as sort of general legal qualifications.
To your point, Dean Bruce wrote in, anyone can make an appointment. The challenge is to make an appointment that all five executive counselors will support. I challenge the governor to do the work necessary to find that nominee and to make that appointment. It's hard work, but that's what's needed.
And you can do that up front. I mean, there are plenty of examples of governors and executive councils or White Houses and U.S. Senate senators going in advance through kind of what a list might look like and who might be acceptable and who might not be.
Well, we've got some other political news to discuss this week, among them the fact that Governor Sununu vetoed 10 bills on Wednesday. He's vetoed quite a few. And these involved, or some of them involved, election and campaigns finance laws, as NHPR reported this week. One bill was designed to identify whether campaign donations from LLC members exceeded contribution limits. Ethan, why did the governor veto this one?
Well, so the general kind of through line for the governor for these election finance bills that he vetoed was he centered around kind of this idea of free political speech. And this is something that, you know, we've seen back as far as Citizens United as an argument that there are different ways to express support, and increasingly kind of financial support is one way to make your voice heard, and that if you change some of the transparency around some of these donations, you're going to effectively chill that because there will be fewer people who want to do it. With the LLCs, this is the LLC loophole has been something that's kind of been used. It's basically a way to get around individual donation limits because you can also donate through an LLC. But that also, donating through that LLC also affords a certain amount of anonymity through that donation. There are things, this law that the governor vetoed would have required those donations to attach the donors' names, their addresses. And so it would kind of remove the veil of anonymity that they received. And Sununu said that that would chill those donations in two ways. One, it would kind of chill the political aspect of it, but it would also kind of prevent some people from even forming LLCs, and he said it would have an impact on businesses.
So it's the assumption being that people would form LLCs just to make political donations anonymously?
Sure, or that they may not form them if they thought that donating through them would mean that their personal information would be suddenly released. So it was that was his argument. The Democratic argument was, and kind of the argument behind the bill was that, you know, these loopholes, there's no need. Everybody else, when you donate to a candidate, your address, your name, all these kind of identifying details are released as part of kind of, if you go above a certain threshold, as part of kind of campaign transparency and campaign finance, and we kind of agreed on this. So why should there be an exception just because you happen to have created this arrangement?
Yeah, the bigger picture here are the number of vetoes that Governor Sununu has issued. I think there were 10 in this batch alone out of 42 bills, and he's vetoed, I think, almost two dozen bills as governor. That's a record. I think John Lynch was in the mid-teens, I believe.
Which is his right to do, and surprising given that the Democrats control the
legislature. Sure, and it gives you some insight into kind of what the re-election strategy may be, that he's going to argue that he's, you know, holding the line against tax and spend Democrats, and that's going to be his take, rather than arguing that look how well I work with Democrats.
He already, so that kind of line was first aired by the Democrats earlier this week. Sununu just broke the record in recent history in the last 30 years, most vetoes by a governor.
He's going to argue that's a virtue,
right,
in this situation.
He actually already, yesterday he issued a fundraising email that pointed, it said something in the subject line, you know, we're breaking a record or something. And then he said, this isn't a record that I want to break, but he's kind of turning it around and saying, if the legislature didn't send me so many bills that they knew would be vetoed, then I wouldn't be vetoing them. And the Democrats say, a lot of these bills have bipartisan support and you're still vetoing them. And so it's going to be something that we see in the next.
Yeah, they're going to argue he's an obstructionist governor, and that if not for him, if there was a Democratic governor, things would be a lot better for New Hampshire citizens. So it's a nice early look at kind of what the rhetorical take is going to be from each side.
And it's worth noting there are so many more bills to come through the pipeline. Just this week, the Senate president released dozens more bills that now start the 5-day clock down that he'll have to either sign today or next week. There's all of the gun bills have yet to be vetoed that are expected to be. There's the voting bills have yet to be vetoed. So there's just a lot more to come. That 24 veto number is likely to be much bigger.
Yeah, and I mean, this really mirrors the national strategy, certainly among Democrats in the U.S. House of Representatives, where they're passing a lot of stuff knowing it's not going anywhere in the Senate, but they want to be able to campaign saying, you know, here's our whole agenda. We've passed it, but Mitch McConnell in the Senate or Donald Trump or either or both are obstructing our agenda. And I think New Hampshire Democrats are going to make the same argument. You hear Dan Feltes make it all the time.
So much of what's happened this week could have been seen weeks ahead or months ahead. I mean, that's, I think, the theme this year legislatively. Almost none of these votes, these vetoes, these outcomes are surprises. And I think that does speak to what you're saying, where there's so much that's sort of telegraphed and it kind of is embedded in the strategies of both sides.
And we've talked, you know, months ago about pieces of legislation where we've said, he's not going to sign this,
right?
But they pass it anyway.
He'll say it as early as February, and then it goes through the process, and then he vetoes it and becomes, you know. So it's just sort of, as a reporter, you sit back and you don't know what to do.
Well, can I ask? Maybe you, Dean, can sort of unpack this weird story for us a little bit. This week, we heard tape of Governor Sununu at a fundraiser. It sounded like he was auctioning off pages of the veto, which. Was politicized
the family, the budget or the Family Medical Leave Act, I believe.
Family Medical Leave Act
veto, yeah.
And so was he really auctioning off the pages or
I don't know if it was the actual original.
It was not.
It was a facsimile.
I actually confirmed this. He does not have a copy of Senate Bill 1, which is family leave. That is given to the Senate clerk's office and kept there. They still have that. So whatever was bought for, I think it was upwards of $400, was not the real veto. I do wonder if the person bidding realized that in the moment. But either way, it was likely a photocopy of some sort.
And legally speaking, is this above board?
I have absolutely no idea. But given that it was, again, very likely a photocopy and not the real thing, I think that should be taken into account.
It feeds into the larger discussion we're having about how he views these vetoes as something to rally Republican supporters in the state.
Okay. One more political thing to talk about, and then I want to talk about, this is sort of political as well, the new Medicaid work requirement. NHPR's Jason Moon's going to join us for that part of the conversation. Senate Majority Leader Dan Feltes says he's considering a run for governor. He won't make that decision officially until later this summer, but he made the announcement in a Medium post to his supporters. Ethan, I want to get your thoughts on A, the fact that he is considering running at all, and B, the timing of this particular bit of news.
Yes. So this is something that has been kind of, again, telegraphed for a while. The field of the Democratic primary will likely grow. You have Molly Kelly and Steve Marchand, who ran last cycle, kind of keeping their foot in the door. But this had been expected for a while. How he was going to roll it out was sort of interesting. And he chose, I think the Democrats have been kind of waiting for this veto threshold to be passed because it was clear early on that Sununu would definitely surpass both his father, whose record was 14 vetoes, and John Lynch, whose record was 15. He's now hit 24. So the day after he does that, Dan Feltes kind of announces. And I think that's sort of, I'm sure this has happened a lot in New Hampshire political history, but you now have a governor and the majority leader of the Senate, who has been the prime sponsor of so many of these bills. Dan Feltes has probably sponsored many, if not most, of the most significant bills that are being vetoed. And so it just creates another political backdrop, just like you have an executive counselor and a governor which we've seen before, who are kind of squaring off in significant ways, like the Gordon McDonald vote. So this is another stage, this veto fight and the budget fight, for there to also be a gubernatorial fight, which you can argue is good or bad for politics.
Mm-hmm. Well, another piece of news that we should talk about this week is that during the first month of a new Medicaid work requirement in New Hampshire, nearly 17,000 recipients were out of compliance. NHPR's Jason Moon is here to tell us a little bit more about that. Thanks very much for being here, Jason.
Happy
really appreciate
to do it.
So this work requirement was meant for people receiving Medicaid, but two-thirds did not fulfill the requirements, or if they did fulfill them, they didn't successfully report it. So we don't really know why, right? There could be a variety of reasons why they didn't.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's safe to say the leading reason is because the state couldn't find them, or that they these folks weren't aware of the requirement, and or didn't know how to comply with it. And the reason we can be relatively certain about that is because we've seen a version of this already play out in Arkansas, which was the first state to implement a work requirement for, and we should specify this is for Medicaid expansion.
Expansion,
so
yes.
Not traditional Medicaid, but folks just above the threshold for Medicaid. And so you have a situation where about two-thirds of people were in non-compliance, and it's also worth pointing out of the one-third who were in compliance, I thank Ethan for asking this question, the majority of those people were deemed so automatically. So I'm still trying to get the actual number of people who were in compliance who actually took action to do so, but it seems like it's even less than one-third. Mm-hmm. And so given that that situation, the state has decided to pause the work requirement. It's going to be suspended through the end of September while they try to continue to reach out to people on Medicaid expansion to let them know that there is a requirement and to let them know about all the ways they could either be exempted from it or could meet the requirement, all the different activities.
And this prompted Governor Sununu, as you mentioned, Jason, to announce that the penalties will be delayed. Here's how the governor spoke about delaying those penalties.
Making sure we get this right is just absolutely paramount. So the idea of giving ourselves another 120 days to move forward on this and get the implementation where we need it to be, it's not just fair to the system, but it's fair to those individuals.
So, Jason, the penalties that would have fallen down on these people would have been a suspension of their benefits, right?
Yeah, they lose their health insurance, right, yeah. Or would have been, if not. And it's worth pointing out, this gets us back into the political sphere a bit, but the whole reason they could pause the work requirement is because Democrats passed a bill this session that that changed some of the requirements for the work requirement and allowed this very thing to happen, where the commissioner could make a determination that not enough people had heard about it, and so we could pause it. And the fact that Governor Sununu signed that bill, which was opposed vehemently all throughout the legislative process by Republicans, was in itself a symbol that they knew the rollout was not going well at all.
And so the state is saying that it's going to do some additional reaching out to people. You reported this week, Jason, they might be going door to door trying to find these people in the dense urban areas. Holly Stevens with the healthcare advocacy group New Futures says the group is skeptical that additional outreach will be able to solve the problem.
With very limited resources and only having an additional 120 days, trying to reach out to 17,000 people, I think is going to be very difficult.
Jason, what do you make of Holly Stevens' assessment there?
Well, I think one important point to pull out of what she said is about the resources. So it's been unclear to me and others throughout this rollout how much money the state has been spending on the rollout, on these outreach efforts. You know, they've put out a lot of numbers about the number of automated phone calls that have been made. And we know that they spent, I think it was like $100,000 and some on this contract with the telemarketing company. Those phone calls, there were 50,000 made, only 10% of people picked up, only 10% of those were actually able to provide the information that allowed them to for them to talk about their work requirement.
So a low return on investment for that effort.
About 500 people.
We just to jump in real quick. This is something I remember when the work requirements were being formulated, both here in New Hampshire and in other states. This was something that was very important to Republicans as a buy-in for expanded Medicaid. And we're talking about 138% of the poverty level. This additional expanded coverage. And you know, the concern up front was that this is exactly what would happen. You're dealing with a population that may not have the same resources as the average New Hampshire citizen. They tend to be more transient. Maybe a little protective of giving out their personal information, dealing with their healthcare when they get these calls. That's a really low yield on the telemarketing. And so, I'm a little skeptical, as the clip you just played said, that they're going to be able to do this, reach 17,000 people in a couple months.
So I just want to So they have definitely pivoted towards door knocking. When at the press conference, we were asking, what about those phone calls? What do you think? And they're like, oh, that was a problem with the phone calls, being able to actually make contact. Actually, their own numbers suggest it's a problem with the door knocking as well. They have, according to this report they released this week, they've done knocked on 1,500 doors since they started door knocking about a week ago. Only 12% of those visits have actually resulted in contact. So even when they're going door to door, it's only getting a fraction. And that's 12% of 1,500. There are still 17,000 people need to be reached. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's granted only in a week and a half. But I think also speaking to Jason's point on the resources, we're in a continuing resolution right now. I mean, the budget is vetoed. There's not a huge amount of money. That the continuing resolution means that there is 3 months worth of the prior year's budget funding allocated to departments. And some departments feel, I don't know about DHHS, but some are already saying we're not going to make it the full 3 months with that amount because of certain obligations. When you're creating a whole new door knocking effort, and they say they're using the same staff that they already have, you can't hire anybody new. You can't, that's eventually going to start taking away from other things those staff were doing. And if you're already failing to kind of get like strong numbers of contact with the door knocking you're already doing, it is really hard to see how they're going to get to 17,000.
This is a structural problem that was people were aware of when they were discussing the whole idea of work requirements. I'm not surprised to see this problem at all.
Well, Jason, really quickly, there are court challenges to the work requirement elsewhere in the country. Would decisions on those challenges render whatever's happening here in New Hampshire kind of moot?
There's actually a court challenge specifically to New Hampshire.
To New Hampshire.
The oral arguments are actually set for the end of this month, and we could get a decision, in the weeks after. So it could be come early August. The whole thing will be put on hold by the federal judge. It'll likely go to appeal, and that'll just sort of add to the confusion of the rollout and for people on Medicaid expansion to not be sure if they're going to be subject to a work requirement. So that's probably the next shoe to drop in all this, is what happens with the federal court case, which the state is an intervener in.
Okay, that's NHPR's Jason Moon. You can find his reporting on the Medicaid expansion work requirement at our website, nhpr.org. Thanks very much for being here, Jason. Really appreciate it.
Happy to do it.
We're going to stay along with Ethan DeWitt and Dean Spiliotis after a break. We're going to be talking about 2020 presidential candidates and who's headed to New Hampshire this weekend. I'm Peter Biello. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup, and we will be right back.
Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Edvest in You, a local New Hampshire nonprofit providing college student loans and student refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. Joining us for the program today, Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, Concord Monitor reporter Ethan DeWitt, and joining us now as we talk about the 2020 presidential election, James Pindell, political reporter for the Boston Globe. James, thank you very much for being on the line with us. Really appreciate it.
Hey, Peter.
So I want to start talking a little bit about Kirsten Gillibrand. She was at Politics and Eggs this week, and here's what she told the crowd of New Hampshire politicos that she wants to prioritize, and that's the establishment of publicly funded elections.
Every candidate out there has a lot of plans, a lot of good ideas. You will not get any of them done if you don't know what's standing in your way. And I promise you, as soon as you get money out of politics, it changes everything.
That's Kirsten Gillibrand at Politics and Eggs this week. James Pindell, what do you think? Kirsten Gillibrand's candidacy.
Well, she has really struggled to break through, not only because she is not clear if she's a hardcore progressive or hardcore moderate. Her positions have shifted on some very key issues over the years of her career, particularly on immigration, which is clearly a hot button topic, as well as on gun control, which is also a very hot topic in today's Democratic primary. There's been a number of stories nationally trying to explore this question of why it hasn't exactly worked out for Kirsten Gillibrand. But the fact of the matter is she is behind a lot of people. And in her home state, her own state senators, members of city councils, mayors are going with other candidates who are from out of state, and that's even before mentioning that the mayor of New York is also running.
Okay. Dean Spiliotis.
Senator Gillibrand has spent a tremendous amount of time here on the ground in New Hampshire. We know she's a Dartmouth alum, so she's familiar with the region. Spent a tremendous amount of time here, very active in retail politics. I think she was just here for 7 days. And the campaign is just not getting the kind of traction you'd want to see as a result of that kind of retail activity. There just seems to be a much higher – I mean, she's focused on women's issues as well, but there just seems to be a lot more intensity surrounding the campaigns of Kamala Harris and Elizabeth Warren. And, you know, we James will remember, we famously used to talk about Joe Lieberman, who kind of as a last-ditch effort in 2004 moved to Manchester for the remainder of the campaign. And so Gillibrand, having spent an entire week here, is starting to get dangerously close to the moving to Manchester stage. So I'm not sure what the answer is for her, but, you know, recent polling has her down at 1% or lower in most cases.
And the next debate, what is the threshold for the next debate polling-wise? Is there a polling threshold from the Democratic Party? James, maybe you know?
Well, yes. So it's a little complicated. The next debate's in just a couple of weeks. That's in Detroit. And for the most part, we know who's going to be in that debate. If you qualify for the last one, you're more than likely to qualify for this one. It gets a little complicated in terms of who qualifies for the 19th or the 20th spot, because we had a number of candidates who did qualify. They're tiebreaker rules. We'll figure that out in the next couple of days. For the most part, that's set. The real test, and this is what's going to have a dramatic impact for the rest of the summer, is how you qualify for the September debate. Now, in context, what they did is the DNC is really kind of running the threshold and running the rules here. They doubled the threshold you needed to do to qualify. And what that might mean on the ground for folks, without getting into the weeds, is that now we've had two nights of debates, right, with 20 candidates on the stage. In September, it is more likely than not, we're going to have just one night with about 8, 9, maybe 10 candidates on the stage. It could cut by half the amount of candidates that are on the stage just because of these DNC rules. And as a result, the field of candidates, the largest and most diverse in American history, may start to winnow pretty dramatically here in the next few weeks and months.
Well, Emerson polling shows that former Vice President Joe Biden has a lead, with a three-way tie with Kamala Harris and Elizabeth Warren. James, in your view, how much does polling matter at this stage?
It matters a lot because of the DNC rules of how you qualify for the debate. This particular poll is not among those that gets included. Right now, candidates are basically doing three things. They're trying to make sure, because of these debate rules, that they have enough contributors to their campaign that they qualify for the debate. Second, they're trying to spend money quickly to get their poll numbers up. You need at least 2% in four different polls to qualify for that September debate. And that's actually a really hard threshold for a number of folks. Right now, we're looking at 6 to 8 qualifying. And third, they're trying to build sort of early state organizations in Iowa and New Hampshire with the money they have that's coming in, so they can develop an infrastructure to win if they go viral or there's a big moment in the campaign, maybe in the next debate, maybe it's something else entirely, that they can take advantage of that. I mean, Pete Buttigieg right now is not at parity with sort of the three main frontrunners in New Hampshire right now, Biden, Sanders, and Warren, but he's got an influx of money and they're going to try to build that infrastructure, for example.
Mm-hmm. Dean Spiliotis.
Yeah, just to kind of give you a hypothetical about how this polling might affect the field, the NBC Wall Street Journal poll that just came out yesterday, national poll, you know, had this group of five that we spent a lot of time talking about: Biden, Warren, Harris, Sanders, and Buttigieg. And then the only other two above 2% or higher are Andrew Yang and Beto O'Rourke. So imagine if that continues on, the impact that would have on the field. All the U.S. senators, Gillibrand, Booker, Klobuchar, they're all 1% or lower in some of these polls. And so, as James said, you could have a really transformed look on the stage in September.
And what Dean has said, I don't want to interrupt it, but what Dean has said is true. And what is, the dynamic that's playing out right now is that I've talked to about 24 activists for a story I'm working on about the state of the New Hampshire primary right now, the state of the race. And, you know, we definitely have a top tier forming. There is between 3 or 6 candidates, depends on how you define it, that are actually in competition, actually in the game. And then there's everyone else. There's a few people on the side, Amy Klobuchar, for example. He mentioned Cory Booker, who may be able to come back up. I don't know what's going on with Beto, even Andrew Yang. But everyone else is just not in the game. And that among those three or four or five or six, it's anyone's guess who's going to win. Biden's dropping, Warren's surging, Sanders is dropping. It's kind of really interesting right now among those actually in contention. And then there's everyone else.
Pete Buttigieg, mayor of South Bend, Indiana, is going to be in New Hampshire this week. He's been in the headlines recently over alleged biased policing in the city of South Bend. His plan to address systemic racism has been sort of the subject of his discussions with hosts on NPR, particularly on Morning Edition this week.
Frankly, it's twice as important if you're a white candidate. It is twice as important for you to be talking about racial inequity and not just describing the problem, which is fashionable in politics, but actually talking about what we're going to do about it and describing the outcomes we're trying to solve for. I think we'll know we're getting somewhere when this is not regarded as some specialty issue that candidates of color talk about or that we only talk about when addressing voters of color. This is a conversation that, frankly, white America needs to have, too.
James Pendle, your thoughts on Pete Buttigieg?
Look, when he first rose up, which was based on a CNN town hall in Austin, Texas, by the way, not in an early primary state, people wondered how long this boomlet would last. That was March. It has lasted, and it's been one of the most impressive things we've seen in modern primary history, is how he's been able to sustain momentum and sustain buzz. He raised more money than anyone else running for president, including Joe Biden. He would raise more money on the Democratic side than anyone else. And he, with that money, he'll be able to paper over some of his problems. But one problem he cannot paper over is something he's trying to address this week and what your clip was addressing. You know, in a lot of polls, his support among African Americans around the country, but particularly in South Carolina, where they make up a majority of the primary vote, is zero. And not just 0%, like literally zero African-Americans say they support him. And so that's one reason why he's trying to take this issue head on. He's trying to build his support because they were very vital nationwide in terms of the primary season. But he's got a lot of problems, but he's got a lot of money, so he can start to fix those problems. And he seems like he's very aggressive in doing that.
Dean Spillios.
Yeah, he is. Absolutely. James is right. He's aggressively trying to fix that with a variety of proposals and speeches and visits to places like South Carolina. You know, the issue for him is once you get past Iowa, New Hampshire, in which the electorate is primarily white, African-American voters become a big part of the Democratic coalition. And as James said, he's down 0, 1, maybe 2% with African-Americans. The danger for him is being labeled as kind of the candidate of high income, high education, white progressive elites. And so he has to figure out how to bring in other aspects of the Democratic coalition if he wants to be viable. But as James says, he raised a tremendous amount of money. He's moving very aggressively. We just don't know if it's going to pay off. Joe Biden is still very strong among African-American voters, particularly older African-American voters.
Well, James Pendle, political reporter for the Boston Globe, thank you very much for joining us. We really appreciate your insights.
Thank you for having me.
Also in the news in New Hampshire this week, Republican Governor Chris Sununu let a bill become law without his signature that would allow driver's licenses or non-driver identification cards to be marked M for male, F for female, or X for other. This driver's license law takes effect on January 1st. Also, the sale of St. Joseph's Church in Laconia has been called off after the prospective buyers withdrew from the agreement. The Catholic Diocese is now considering a plan to sell parts of the property while preserving the church itself. A group of community members in Laconia has been working since May to stop the planned demolition of the church. And Governor Sununu is set to sign a bill today authorizing sports betting in New Hampshire. The bill will allow mobile gambling and wagering at up to 10 retail locations across the state. The State Lottery Commission will supervise and regulate the new industry. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. Still to come, the Concord School Board grapples with how it's handling student allegations of teachers' sexual assault. NHPR's Sarah Gibson has been reporting on this, and she's going to join us. I'm Peter Biello. We'll continue after a short break. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. In the studio with me, Ethan DeWitt, reporter for the Concord Monitor, Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU. And joining us for this part of the program is NHPR's Sarah Gibson. Thank you very much, Sarah, for joining us.
You're welcome.
So, Sarah, I want to ask you first about the Learn Everywhere proposal. Among Governor Sununu's vetoes this week was his veto of a bill that would have given more control to school boards, and that was meant to head off this policy, Learn Everywhere. So, Sarah, can you explain sort of the connection between this bill that the governor vetoed and Learn Everywhere?
Sure. So Learn Everywhere is a set of proposed rules from the State Board of Education that's very much been championed by the Commissioner of Education, Frank Edelblue. It would basically require high schools, public high schools, to grant credit towards high school graduation to students who are doing learning outside the classroom, as long as it's approved by the State Board of Education. So if the State Board of Education says, yes, dance studio, or yes, first robotics, or yes, Chinese language class, you are approved by us, that a student who's attending those extracurriculars starts getting credit towards their high school graduation, even if the local school board says, we don't really approve of that. So it's been pretty contentious, but the supporters say that it will really expand opportunities for students. It's been contentious, particularly among Democrats and traditional supporters of public education. And so this bill that was just vetoed, SB 140, was meant to really put the final say in how credits happen with the local school boards so they could essentially override the State Board of Education were it to go forward with Learn Everywhere.
Mm, so that was vetoed. So
it was.
So Learn Everywhere seems like it's is it a sure thing?
It's not yet a sure thing. So next week, the joint you guys are going to need to help me out. Joint Legislative Committee on Administrative Rules is going to discuss that those proposed rules from the State Board of Education. They could send it back and say, hey, you guys need to look at this again. There certainly is going to be a lot of resistance and concern that those people hear from educators about
so
moving forward.
You say educators are not in favor of Learn Everywhere?
Most public school educators I've spoken to are very opposed to it.
I'm just going to point in. So Jill Carr is the committee that kind of actually wield a lot of power. It's like kind of not they're not well known, but secretly they kind of can craft. When you pass a bill, suddenly that goes to a department. They have to decide kind of the mini rules within that bill that weren't really laid out. And there's just been a debate in the past few weeks, and I'm sure for years as well, over kind of what the role of Jill Carr should be. So technically the role is not to weigh in on policy, which means that even though this is a democratically controlled committee, it's a joint committee between the House and the Senate, there shouldn't be kind of an overruling of these Department of Education proposed rules just on the basis of we don't like this Learn Everywhere program. And yet, inevitably things become political, and there have been kind of votes in this session and past sessions where people have said this is Jill Carr muscling in. So what it'll be very interesting to see next week kind of what they decide to do. And, they have a lot of power even if they don't change the overall intent of the rules. They can tweak the rules within them to create exceptions and et cetera. So.
Yeah, the politics of this are really interesting. You basically, you typically have conservatives speaking in favor of local control on education decisions. Frank Edelblue, conservative head of the education department here in the state. But here's a case where, some Democrats argue that this is essentially an end run around public education, that it's a way to shift education more towards private types of choice. So the politics are a little inverted on this compared to what we usually hear.
Yeah, and you do see there were tons of comments in response to the Learn Everywhere proposed rules. And, superintendents and school boards across the state were saying this takes away local control. And kind of interesting to see them partnering very much with Democratic legislators to get rid of Learn Everywhere.
Well, Sarah Gibson, I want to ask you about another story that you were following this week. The Concord School Board held a public hearing on Monday to gather input on sexual harassment, abuse, and community safety. This comes after police accused Howie Lee Young, a special education teacher at Runlet Middle School, of sexually assaulting a former Concord student. So, Sarah, why did officials think a discussion like this, the one you attended on Monday night, was necessary?
Sure. So Leung was previously at the middle school, and then until this past spring, he was actually at the high school. Mm-hmm. And so they thought it was necessary because they've been getting a lot of pushback and concern from parents across the district who feel as though the district mishandled allegations and concerns raised by students about Leung's behavior for many years, going back at least 5 years. So this was actually a committee within the school board that looks at conduct, and they were looking at kind of the holes in their existing conduct policy and asking for parent input into what can we tell, how can we train staff, and what can we tell students and staff so that this kind of thing doesn't happen in the future.
Yeah. So what was the big takeaway from the meeting, or were there more than, was there more than one takeaway?
There certainly were. I would say one of the major gaps that people identified quickly was that right now teachers and staff go through no training on sexual harassment or sexual assault in Concord. That means that if you start there, no one gives you any kind of best practices for what to do if one of your students says, I feel uncomfortable around a teacher. That could have been really helpful because basically what happened was that students who did raise issues faced retaliation and resistance by teachers. So that training is definitely sounds like it's a priority from the district, even from the superintendent, as well as for the parents. The takeaway is that parents really want to see the results of an investigation by the school district.
Yeah, one of the parents in attendance, Betsy McNamara, says they want the district to share the report from its internal investigation into the case.
We just need to see that report to the full extent possible while protecting confidentiality. And parents will be applying the pressure for that.
So did the school board make any commitments to that point?
So they haven't seen the full report yet. It is due by the end of the month. So they basically said, we don't know how much is confidential in this report. We don't know how much pertains to the ongoing criminal investigation. Therefore, we can't say exactly how much we can give to you. But we do want to give a redacted version to parents, to the public, so that they can understand as much as is possible without obviously breaching confidentiality issues. But parents really are concerned that could be the confidentiality issue could be kind of a facade so that the district doesn't necessarily have to give as much information as it should.
Mm-hmm. What about the Leung case? Where does that stand now?
So he's, as far as we know, he's still in Massachusetts because that's where the charges originated. And he is facing a bail hearing, I believe, later on, but currently is facing multiple very serious felony level charges for sexual assault against one student. However, he might be facing more charges in New Hampshire. We don't yet know. There is a Concord police investigation that's ongoing. The Department of Education is also investigating. So it could be that there are more charges and even more victims we hear about in the alleged victims we hear about in the future.
NHPR Sarah Gibson, thank you very much for sharing your reporting on this. Really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
And listeners, you can find links to her reporting at nhpr.org. Also in the news this week, the towns of Peterborough and Jaffrey are considering a joint project to buy and manage a group of wells for their municipal water systems. Both towns are facing possible water shortages. Peterborough has industrial toxins in its town well, and Jaffrey is expecting a big bump in demand as a large pharmaceutical company, MilliporeSigma, expands its Jaffrey office. Peterborough voters already approved money for the project, and Jaffrey voters will consider it in March. Also, a new law signed by the governor this week claims to help people with felony convictions better understand their voting rights. The new law clarifies that people who have been convicted of felonies can vote once they're released from prison, and even if they're still on probation or parole. The law also requires probation and parole officers to receive training on felon voting rights. So let's move on to the fun part of the show, which is the animal stories. The Concord Monitor reported last week that a rooster was found left alone with a bag of food outside the State House doors. And for more on this, we're going to turn to Sarah Persichino, Communications Director for the State Senate. Sarah, welcome.
Good morning, Peter. Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you here. And we're talking to you because you are now the keeper of this rooster, yes?
I am. It lives with us in Hopkinton.
How's the rooster doing?
He is great. It was unclear when we first found him at the State House whether it was a hen or a rooster, but after a few early morning calls, we can definitely confirm that he is a rooster.
Okay, so what do we know about the rooster's appearance? I guess not much, right? Like, just kind of left there with food, and here you go, here's a rooster?
Yeah, the exact origin is unclear, and it was, as I said, unclear about the gender at first, but in the state Senate offices, we started referring to the chicken pretty affectionately as Emaud Chickenson, which is in honor of our first female state senator, Emaud Ferguson. But since then, since he's come home with us, my children have renamed him. My 5-year-old daughter refers to him as Max, and my 2-year-old insists that he is a girl and calls her Shelby. So he's being well taken care of.
So was the at the time, chicken, now rooster, sort of wandering around the state house when it appeared?
And... Yeah, he was on the lawn and someone had left food in a cup on the steps. So the state house staff caught him and we had him in the state house courtyard for a little while, which is inside of the building, a little outdoor space.
Okay, and confirm that this rooster is in fact the exact state bird, right?
It is. It's a New Hampshire red.
You got to wonder if that's related.
It is unknown. If someone knows where it came from, we haven't found out yet.
Well, Sarah, we did want to bring you in just to check up on this story because it gained a lot of traction last week, and we didn't have the roundup last week, so we had to mention it.
Perfect.
I just want to point out that it was kind of remarkable how many people in the State House actually are equipped to handle a chicken left abandoned.
Well, a rooster, then you're getting into neighbors and crowing and all that.
Sure, but I mean, I believe what I heard is at least 2 or 3 other staffers were ready to take this chicken in and actually kind of knew what to do.
Well, I wonder if their offers still stand, maybe more roosters will end up in the State House. That's not an invitation. That's not an invitation to leave chickens at the State House. Sarah Perschino, thank you very much for joining us. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
So we had an abundance of animal stories this week. I just want to mention another one really quickly before we have to close out, which is that WMUR reported this week that a couple drove a pair of horses through a Dunkin' Donuts drive-thru, which is possibly the most New England thing I've seen in a long time. WMUR reported that the horses are named Angel and Gracie, and they've gone through the drive-thru before, according to their owner. Sometimes they get donuts. But not this time. Just coffees for the riders. Did you see this, Ethan? Are you looking at it right now?
I'm looking at it right now. Yeah. I hadn't seen it before this, but yeah, I would kind of like to have a horse every time I go through Dunkin' Donuts just as an excuse to. You know,
can you see? I don't know if there are pictures there. Do you see cup holders on the horse?
Yeah,
The picture that I no. I'm sure that they're deep in the background, but I can't quite see them.
The horses are actually the perfect height for the window, so it works out quite well.
You couldn't not take them through.
There's no door in the way, so you can lean close to the... Yeah.
If you're walking by Dunkin' Donuts, you're wasting opportunities on a horse.
We have officially learned the best way to go through a drive-thru. Okay. So just a reminder that over the weekend, temperatures are going to be in the 80s, so a reminder that if your pets are very uncomfortable in hot cars, even for short periods of time, high temperatures can be deadly for your pets, so treat your pets with love. Keep them cool and comfortable during the hot weather this weekend. That said, I want to ask everybody here what you'll be looking forward to in the next week news-wise. Ethan, we'll start with you. Real quick.
So the rumor is today the Democrats in the State House are sitting down for the first of likely many talks with the governor's side on the budget. And so we'll see what comes out of that. They have 3 months.
Sarah Gibson, what will you be reporting on next
week? Well, this Administrative Rules Committee talking about Learn Everywhere next Thursday.
Okay. Dean, what will you be watching?
Watching the ripples of this, confirmation battle over Gordon McDonald, see how that plays out. Also, a lot of 2020 candidates coming through the state this weekend.
Lots happening in the next week. We'll talk about it at the roundup next week. We hope you will join us. Thank our guests again for being on the program today. Ethan DeWitt of the Concord Monitor, Sarah Gibson from NHPR, and Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU. Really appreciate having your insights today. That's going to be it for today, but you can join the conversation as it continues on Facebook and read all the stories we talked about today at nhpr.org. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Michael Brindley is our program manager, producer Jessica Hunt, and Christina Phillips, producer and operator of the cameras today on Facebook Live. You can watch a video of this by searching for NHPR Exchange on Facebook. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you very much for listening and have a great weekend.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.